Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Have you ever longed to possess something that wasn't for sale at any price? What would you be willing to risk in order to get it? For a young man named Thad Roberts, being accepted into NASA's elite intern program at Johnson Space Center represented a major triumph over alienation from his own church and family and over a once rocky academic career. But driven by the desire to impress a new girlfriend, and at least partially by good old-fashioned greed, Roberts pushed his luck one giant step too far by stealing a collection of lunar minerals valued at millions of dollars per gram from the lab of a researcher he idolized. How he did it and how he got caught is the subject of a new book by author Ben Mezrich called Sex on the Moon, the amazing story behind the most audacious heist in history. Ben, welcome back to Think.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So, if you had set out to write a fictional story of an adventure-seeking felon, it seems highly unlikely that you would have created a character like Thad Roberts. Tell us a little bit about his early life.
Yeah, I mean, he's the most complex guy I've ever written about. Thad Roberts was a kid who grew up in a very hardcore, fundamentalist Mormon family. He was kicked out of his house at the age of 18 for admitting to having premarital sex. He was actually kicked off of his Mormon mission and then banished to the basement of his house, and then he had to leave. So he had a pretty troubled childhood, I guess. But he was a very smart kid, and, you know, he basically reformed his whole life after that.
So he went on to marry that high school sweetheart right. And was married to her during some of his time at the University of Utah. But he still was struggling. How did he settle on the idea that he wanted to be an astronaut?
Well, really, you know, he was working jobs. He was at the University of Utah. You know, he was married at 18. And then he wandered into the Career Center and he found a file. It was marked astronaut. And as he looked through it, he decided, you know, I really want to do this. I want to be an astronaut. And it was as simple as that. He just set his mind on it and he said, I'm going to do whatever it takes to try and get into NASA and to get accepted there.
And so for the next couple of years, he worked incredibly hard, not only to sort of turn his life around, but to excel, it sounds like, at nearly everything he did.
Yeah, I mean, he was a triple major. He was in geology, physics, and astronomy. He learned how to fly airplanes. He learned how to scuba dive. He learned five languages. He became an expert at paleontology. He worked at the museum. He did all these things because he knew these were all things that an astronaut might need to do. And so he did all of this over a period of a couple of years, and then he applied to what's called the co-op program at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, which is essentially for college kids. It's incredibly prestigious and hard to get into, and you do three semester tours there while you're in college, and a lot of the kids then go on and get hired by NASA.
Now, it turns out that he did, even at the University of Utah, develop a weird sort of sense of entitlement to some geological specimens. Can you talk about
that? Yeah. So he was working at the Museum of Utah, and there were some, you know, as there are in any museum, fossils and rocks and things like that that aren't on display, and they're kept sort of in the basement. And he thought to himself, you know, if no one's using these, I'm going to take them. So he just put them in his pocket. And then he displayed them at his house, you know, at dinner parties. So he stole a bunch of, you know, many millions of years old rocks. He has a different sense of right and wrong.
So what sort of work did he do that first semester that he was working at Johnson Space Center?
Well, I mean, he did all sorts of things. He worked in a lab where they were working on materials used in space. He also did end up working with lunar rocks a lot. He worked in the NBL, it's called, which is the giant swimming pool where they sink a space station, they sink a giant space shuttle, and the astronauts go down in their spacesuits and they work underwater. And since Thad was a scuba expert, he would dive down and help the astronauts as they worked in these mock space stations. All sorts of things like that. But eventually he did get to catalog rocks in the lunar lab. And that's when he realized that there was stuff here that was incredibly valuable.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think people are aware that NASA must have a cache of these things.
Right.
The vast majority of them, I guess, stay in a really pristine environment, but there's a tiny fraction that is brought out and used for experimentation. Is that right?
Right. I mean, there's 840 pounds of moon rocks in existence that have been brought back by hand from the moon. So there can't be any more, you know, because we're not going back to the moon anytime soon. They're the most valuable thing on Earth in that a single gram was once offered for $5 million. But it's really hard to say what they're really worth because we can't get them again. So they're really invaluable, and they're illegal to own. And so of this 840 pounds, about 17 pounds is considered used because it's already been experimented on. It's no longer in the pristine sealed condition it was in coming back from the moon. And in the lunar lab, which is this really cool building, you get in through an airlock, you wear all white, you know, you go through these vacuum areas, and they have all these shelves. But in the back, there's a safe for these used moon rocks. And so originally, that's what Thad was centered on. He considered them NASA's trash. Since NASA wasn't using them anymore, he thought, you know, I might be able to liberate them.
Now, NASA has never considered selling these trashed rocks. Is that correct?
No, but a lot of the scientists do joke about that, that when they're having their meetings, you know, NASA has a lot of financial problems, as we now know. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, they're shutting down things, and they have 840 pounds of something that's this valuable. You know, a lot of the scientists are like, oh, they should sell some of it. But no, NASA has no plans to do that. They do often, you know, have them shown at high schools. The president sometimes gives moon rocks as gifts to other, you know, prime ministers or leaders of other countries. But no, they're never sold.
Okay, so we have Roberts at this co-op program at Johnson Space Center. In addition to having turned his academic life around, it seems like when he got there into the co-op program, he was also ready to really have a sort of makeover of his public persona. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. He became this social star at NASA because he grew up, he was a shy kid. He, you know, grew up in a very serious, fundamental, you know, Mormon household. Once he hits NASA, he becomes, you know, the leader of all the co-ops and interns. He's doing these every weekend, taking them on cliff diving expeditions or rock climbing. And he also starts this game where all the interns and co-ops would compete on who could do kind of the craziest thing. So at one point, he sneaks into the space shuttle simulator. So he's already pushing the boundaries there of what's right and what's wrong in a way. But he becomes this star, and everyone kind of describes him as overly enthusiastic. He's a James Bond kind of guy. He's really thought of as this very cool guy.
And he is nice looking. I mean, it's not like he would have been socially awkward necessarily. He had a lot going for him.
Yeah, he's not like, normally I write about geeky guys who can't get laid. And this was a guy who everyone kind of loved. I mean, he's good looking. He's outdoorsy. You know, he can do everything. I mean, he's bike riding and scuba diving and cliff diving. So, you know, everyone looks at him as this kind of hero.
So James Bond does not have a wife. What happened with well, Robert's wife?
Exactly. Well, you know, him and his wife start to kind of fall apart. So he's, you know, at NASA, then he goes back to Utah. But when he's back at Utah, they really don't have much in common anymore. And she's gotten into modeling, and he's, you know, all he cares about is NASA and the stars and space and stuff like that. So they really, their relationship starts to fall apart. And he, you know, sets his sights on this other girl. And that's kind of where things start to go wrong.
All right, we'll set that aside for a moment and talk about when Roberts first started thinking, just a kernel of an idea, what would happen if I got my hands on these rocks?
Yeah, so, you know, he's working cataloging moon rocks. He starts to think about it. It starts to, you know, obsess about it. He lives in this kind of fantasy world. I describe him as very delusional often. And he starts to think to himself, you know, I could do this. I could be like James Bond, or this could be like Ocean's 11. And he starts to come up with this scheme. And then he starts to think, well, what would I do if I got them? And essentially, he's hanging out at the University of Utah, and he meets this guy named Gordon, who's this druggie. You know, when he meets him, he, you know, Gordon's smoking pot, and Thad thinks to himself, well, this guy smokes pot. He must know criminals. So he literally goes up to him, you know, and they become friends, and he says, if I had some moon rocks, could you find a way to sell them? Yeah, that's as simple as it is, yeah.
So Gordon says, well, I'll look into it for you, basically?
Well, first thing Gordon says is, you don't think we really went to the moon, did you? Because he doesn't realize that even works at NASA. He starts to think, well, yeah, I could probably find a way to sell it. And so he starts going on the school computers and just shooting out emails that basically say, does anybody want to buy a moon rock? And any of us who looks at that just thinks this is utterly stupid because you know you're going to get caught when you do something like that. But they don't think about that. They're not these master criminals, you know. They're just college kids, really. And so he starts shooting out emails and he gets a bite, you know, from someone in Belgium.
And this guy in Belgium, Axel Emmermann, at first thinks, well, this is just a scam, right? He doesn't imagine
right.
That it's a real moon rock.
And Axel Ungerman is this great character. I mean, he's perfect for Hollywood. He's this guy. He's never been out of Belgium in his life. He collects minerals on the, as a side. His wife's name is Crystal, which is perfect for a mineral collector. You know, he's a popinjay expert, which is this weird sport where there's a wooden bird on a 100-foot pole, and you stand around and shoot crossbows at it. And so he's this really odd Belgian guy, but he has this real feeling of right and wrong. And when he gets this email, he starts to think there's either a hoax going on or there's a crime about to be committed. And so he writes an email to the Tampa FBI and just says, I think someone's about to steal moon rocks. And that starts this investigation.
And he writes to Tampa because he essentially figures that it must be NASA in Florida.
Well, you know, he knows there's, you know, he's a rock specialist, essentially. So he knows if it really is moon rocks that this guy's going to sell, there's only one place you can get moon rocks. And that's NASA in Houston. But the emails that had been sent out had a Florida were from Tampa. That's the, you know, Gordon just came up with a character in Tampa. So that's essentially why he goes to Florida. But, you know, It's pretty random, you know, out of the blue, essentially, FBI gets this email, and the FBI doesn't even know if this is real or even if there's a crime about to be committed, but they start to get interested.
And so they take him seriously enough, Emmerman, to say, all right, here's what you ought to do, and they give him some instructions for the next time he's contacted by Thad Roberts' pseudonym. Is that right?
Right. So Emmerman essentially becomes, you know, a wannabe FBI agent in a way. He starts contacting back and forth with Thad, and Thad has taken over from Gordon at this point, and pretending to be interested in buying moon rocks. And eventually they settle on a price of $100,000. Thad has not done anything yet. He hasn't, you know, stolen anything yet. He hasn't even really come to the conclusion that he's going to do it. To him, it's kind of this game right now. You know, he's sending an email back and forth with this guy, but he doesn't really have it all planned out yet. And it's a question of whether he would actually do it or not. Until he sort of meets his catalyst, which is this girl.
So in the book, you call her Rebecca. That's actually not right. her real name.
Not her name.
We'll talk about that in a minute. But they fall in love very quickly. And she's another intern in the co-op program.
Yeah, she's an intern. She's, you know, blown away by Thad Roberts. She thinks of him as this James Bond guy. She describes him as, you know, he could do anything. And, you know, they meet and it's like head over heels love right away. I mean, they're together from almost the minute that they meet. You know, it's one of those things where he falls head over heels, completely in love. He forgets about his wife, essentially. And he says to her, you know, he actually tells her that he's thinking of stealing moon rocks. And he does it trying to impress her, expecting her to say, are you crazy? Don't do something like that. But she immediately says, you know, that sounds romantic. Let's do it. And from that moment on, it goes from being this kind of fantasy to something that Thad intends to do.
So his M.O. when he finally does this is clever in some ways and yet remarkably crude in others. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, to get into the lunar lab becomes impossible. He realizes that he can't get into the lunar lab. But what he also realizes is that there's a 600-pound safe in his boss's office, and this eminent scientist named Everett Gibson, which also contains moon rocks that have been used in experiments. So he shifts his plan over to robbing this lab. And the lab is actually hard to get into. I mean, it takes a lot. It's very Ocean's 11 when they finally do it.
Let me jump in here. We'll take a quick break. My guest this hour is author Ben Mezrich. His newest book is called Sex on the Moon, The Amazing Story Behind the Most Audacious Heist in History. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You're welcome to join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Ben Mezrich. His newest book is called Sex on the Moon, the amazing story behind the most audacious heist in history. If you've got a question, you can phone in to 1-800-933-5372 or send it via email to think@kera.org. So Ben, let's back up here for a minute. How secure is NASA?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. There are certain areas that are very secure. But once you're on the inside, it's not that secure. I mean, you have to remember, he was one of their own. You know, he had NASA ID. He worked there every day. He was in the labs. He was you know, diving with the astronauts. And so they never expected someone who was there to do something like this. But the lab he robbed, you know, it had a cipher lock, which is this electronic, you know, those keypads. Mm-hmm. So he had to figure out how to get that combination. And what he ended up doing was using fluorescing powder on the keys, which would show when you put a black light on it which keys had been pressed. He had to get past all the cameras, which was just essentially knowing where they were. He chose a rainy night because he knew the security guards wouldn't come out of their kiosks in the middle of a pouring rainstorm. He borrowed a Jeep from a friend who also worked at NASA. So he had NASA tags and everything on it. And then, you know, he switched the license plates of the Jeep. They prepared a hotel room for when they were going to get the moon rocks out. And it was him and these two girls, his girlfriend and this other girl who was his confidant. And they were the three, you know, conspirators. They got onto the NASA campus and pulled it off.
Now, let's explain for a minute why the FBI, alerted to the fact that somebody might be about to steal moon rocks, did not contact NASA.
Well, they didn't contact NASA because they knew if this was a real crime about to be committed, it would have to be someone on the inside at NASA. So they didn't want to just barge into NASA and say, you know, someone's about to steal a moon rock, because then they would never catch the person. And at about this point, they started to realize this was probably a real theft about to happen, and they really wanted to catch the person. And they had Axel Emmermann. You know, they were emailing back and forth with the person about to pull it off. So rather than, you know, barge into NASA, they decided to do a sting operation, which was, you know, ended up working out great for them. And it was a big operation at the time that involved, you know, many, many agents. And, you know, Thad walked right into it.
So they're in the office of this, is it Dr. Gibson? Yeah, Dr. Gibson.
Yes.
But they can't open the safe there, so they take the whole thing with them.
Right. So his original plan was to crack the safe. He thought he knew the combination because previously he had gone to that office when he was still married to his wife, and Gibson had given a gift to her of a piece of a sample of some sort. And he had seen the safe, and on top of the safe were these numbers that he thought was the safe's combination. In reality, it was actually an algorithm you could use to figure out the combination of the safe, but Thad didn't realize that. But just in case, he did bring along a mechanized dolly with him. So when he goes and tries to crack the safe, he realizes he can't. So he and these girls end up having to hoist the 600-pound safe out of NASA. And the crazy thing is, the speed limit at NASA is only 5 miles per hour. So the whole getaway, you know, there's these three kids in a Jeep with a 600-pound safe of moon rocks, is at 5 miles per hour through the whole place. But, you know, they make it off the campus, and they get these moon rocks out to, you know, and they open it. And when they open it, they realize they have a piece of the moon from every moon landing in history.
Hmm.
So there's a piece from every Apollo mission, you know, including the original one. And there's also a piece of Mars in there, a Mars rock. And this Mars rock was special. It was the actual piece that was once, you know, used to show that there might have once been life on Mars. So it's an incredibly valuable theft. You know, Thad calls it the most valuable rock collection in the world.
So it was Thad who contacted you after this was all over to tell his story. On the one hand, you found him to be an interesting and complex character. On the other hand, he really did sort of commit a crime against the United States. Did you have to sort of wrestle with your relationship to him and what he did in order to write this story?
Yeah, it was very interesting. So I was contacted. He was out of prison, and mutual friends who were fans of mine, you know, reached out to me and said, "You got to meet this guy." And I'd never heard this story before. So I got on a plane, and it was the first time I'd met someone who'd spent that much time in prison. I mean, he spent 7.5 years in prison, had just gotten out. He was on probation. So I met him in this crowded hotel lobby. But he was a really nice guy, very smart, you know, soft-spoken. He knew he'd done something wrong, but he also felt he'd served in a massive amount of time in prison for it. And, you know, it is interesting. You know, when my dad first heard the story, and he's an engineer, he hated this kid. He was like, this guy betrayed science. He stole a national treasure. Men gave their lives, you know, risked their lives to get these moon rocks. And, you know, there is that. But there also is this feeling that this kid really thought it was a college prank. You know, he was really smart. He was kind of messed up. And he did something stupid, and he paid for it in a very big way. So I had mixed feelings about it, but I really wanted to get into the story, and I wanted to get into this kid's head. And so I spent a year working with him, and I also immediately filed with the FBI to get all the FBI files. So 1,000 pages finally arrived, and I was able to cross-check everything. And in the beginning, he wasn't telling me the truth. He was, you know, exaggerating the crime and all these kind of things. And eventually I was able to confront him on the aspects of it that I knew were not true. And then he began to really open up to me.
How much material? You mentioned that it was samples from every lunar landing, but how much material overall was inside that 600-pound site?
Well, it was only a little over 100 grams. But as I said, 1 gram was once offered for $5 million. So it's hard to say how much it's really worth. When he was charged with the crime, they came to a calculation of $21 million. And the reason they came to that calculation is they took into consideration all of the pounds of moon rocks that we've brought back and how much would it cost today to go get that much moon rocks. And then 100 grams of that is worth $21 million. You know, who knows what the street value of moon rocks is, but that's the crime. You know, they charged him with stealing that much.
So before we get to the big takedown, and we'll be careful with language because this is a, a public radio station, but explain your title.
I'm usually not that careful with language, so thank you for telling me that. Mm-hmm. But, my wife actually came up with the title. I was thinking the lunar heist or the moon rock heist. But the reality is when he gets these moon rocks to Florida and he's about to do this big deal, he spreads them on a bed and has sex on them with his girlfriend. And that was his plan. He wanted to give her the moon. And so my wife said, well, you just call it Sex on the Moon. And so I did. And I don't know if it's getting caught in spam filters or not, but it seems to be my first title that might actually make it to the movie. So I'm happy with the title.
And there is for sure a movie already in the works. Is that right?
Yeah, I sold it to the same producers of The Social Network. So it's Scott Rudin and Kevin Spacey and Dana Bernetti and Mike DeLuca, and it's Sony Pictures, and they've already got a director. So it looks really good right now, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about they have the rocks, and they're supposed to meet their what they think is a not legitimate buyer, but what they think is a real buyer in Orlando, Florida.
Right, so they think they're still, you know, negotiating with this Belgium mineral guy and that he sent his sister and brother-in-law or whatever to come buy them. So, you know, Thad gets ready. He goes to meet them. He's staying in a Sheraton hotel, and he goes to meet them in this restaurant in Orlando, Florida. It's kind of a chain restaurant. And the first thing he notices when he walks in is that everyone in the restaurant is, like, between the ages of 30 and 40. And he thinks this is a little odd, but it doesn't dawn on him. It's because everyone there was an FBI agent. And he sits down with these people, and it's crazy. So I got all of the transcripts of everything that was said in the restaurant because the FBI agents were wearing wires. And when I filed with the FBI, they gave me these transcripts. And it's amazing. I mean, the first thing, you know, he says is, if you're wearing a wire, I'm screwed right now. and you know, that's a horrible thing to say to an FBI agent who's wearing a wire. And from that moment on, it's just this crazy scene where, you know, Gordon is there, the kind of druggy guy is there, and he's drunk, and the girl is there, and Thad is there, and they're talking about how they should make a movie out of my life. And meanwhile, these FBI agents are sitting there realizing that this is a college kid, this isn't some criminal, but, you know, they're going to take him down. And it is a really big takedown. They end up, you know, closing a major highway in Florida. There's agents with guns and helicopters, and it just kind of it goes down like that. It's just this crazy scene.
What did Thad tell you about? Because they allowed him to sort of get them, make the exchange, and then they arrested him in the parking lot. Is that right?
Right. So they bring in this suitcase with $100,000 in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Thad's never seen $1,000, let alone $100,000. And they drive back to the hotel because they want to get to where the moon rocks are. And once they get to the hotel parking lot, that's when they take him down.
I mean, was he thinking, this is awesome, I totally pulled it off?
He really is, and it doesn't dawn on him until he sees the guns, essentially, that he's getting caught. You know, it's crazy. Any of us looking at it are thinking, oh, this guy should have seen this coming, and there were so many different points when he could have stopped himself. You know, he shouldn't have done it, and then once he's got them, he should have immediately just returned them. He should have realized somewhere along the way that he was going to get caught. You know, I asked him a lot of times, you know, what were you thinking? How did you think you would get away with this? And he said, you know, it was never really about that. I didn't even think it through. I thought I would sell some, I'd get some money, I'd go to Africa with my girlfriend, and it would just go away. And it's just sort of this weird disconnect.
And they did, right after the night where they stole this stuff, they sort of showed up for work the next day like everything was normal?
Yeah, and you know, NASA didn't notice the safe was missing for 48 hours because Gibson was out of town. Nobody saw this missing 600-pound safe. So for a couple days, you know, he went back to work. He was working in the giant swimming pool. And then it spreads all over NASA that this thing was stolen. And all of the kids are talking about it like, oh, this is really amazing. Someone stole $1 trillion worth of moon rocks because they thought it was a 600-pound safe full of moon rocks, even only had 100 grams in it. But it made them very nervous, but they still went along with their plan. And so they only had the moon rocks for a matter of days before they were caught.
I can't imagine myself committing a crime like this to begin with, but I think that's what would have gotten me when everybody around me was talking about who had done this thing, and I knew the whole story.
Yeah, that you know that you knew that you had a tackle box. He put it in a tackle box, so he had this tackle box full of moon rocks. It is crazy. I mean, you would think at that point you would fall apart, but Thad remained very calm. The girl started to panic a little bit, but he stayed in control the whole time. And, you know, he's a bit of, you know, delusional or whatever you want to say it. But he's a little crazy.
Now, in the book, you call the girls Rebecca and Sandra. That's not their real names, and their names are a matter of public record. So I'm curious as to why you changed those details. Did they ask for that?
Yeah, she did. I spoke to the main girl, Rebecca, I call her in the book, and she was not happy that I was doing this. Mm-hmm. She was, you know, she's gone on with her life. She's a professor somewhere. She's put this behind her. And she doesn't want everyone to know. But, you know, I was writing the book, and I just agreed to change her name, although anybody who Googles it can figure it out in 2 seconds. It's just something I did, you know, as a favor to her, even though it's all public record. And, you know, I don't try and make anyone look bad in these books. It's not sort of I'm not this sort of hatchet journalist trying to get at people. But this is a true story. And this is what happened. And so I just changed the names out of respect for her wishes.
Is Thad making money from you telling his story?
No, I mean, not for me. You know, if the movie gets going and if they hire him for a consultant or something like that, I'm sure that's something that could happen. But no, I didn't pay him anything. It's, you know, I'm not a biographer. You know, I'm not a ghostwriter. I write these crazy stories. And he could find a way, become a speaking, you know, do speaking or whatever it is. I'm not paying him for the information, though.
So the FBI was more than happy to tell their side of this story because they come out looking great. What was NASA's response?
Well, the FBI wasn't. They didn't offer me anything, actually. I had to file the Freedom of Information Act and get the files. So none of the agents would actually talk to me. NASA was not thrilled. They saw this, you know, as an embarrassment when it came out. They pretty much didn't let the story get out. And they had told all the scientists not to speak to me. So what I did is I just went on their website and I signed up for what's called a Level 9 tour, which is this like internal tour of NASA. And I was fully expecting them to cross-check my name.
Uh-huh.
But I showed up to NASA, and then I'm in there, and I'm in all these places, in the NBL, and I'm standing at the giant pool, and I'm in mission control. And Thad is texting me and telling me where to go. And he's like, I used to sit right there in the cafeteria or go down this hallway, and that's where I used to hang out. And so, you know, I was having the ultimate guided tour of NASA by the guy who robbed NASA. So I'm not sure the security is all that much better than it was back then. but yeah, it was pretty interesting. And so it was tricky. You know, NASA was not pleased that I was writing this book. But I do think when they read it, they will like it because it's all about the fun and crazy and just incredible stuff that goes on there. I'm a big fan of NASA. Part of the reason I wanted to write this book is because when you picture NASA, you're picturing the 60s. You know, you're picturing Tom Hanks in a little silver capsule floating around, you know, the moon. But that's not what NASA's like today. And so I wanted to tell a story about NASA today, and Thad is just sort of one of the mechanisms to do that.
It does come across the culture there as a lot looser, and I don't mean this in a security sense, but a lot more fun, maybe, than we might have imagined.
I mean, I think that's what it is. I mean, these scientists could work in other places, but they choose to work there because they love space and they love, you know, the whole idea of we went to the moon, let's go to Mars. You know, it's all about going to Mars. And so there is something very fun about these sort of geeky people all kind of dreaming about the same thing. I think it's something that's awesome, and it's sad to see what's going on right now with sort of the closing of the shuttle program and who knows what's next for NASA. I think it's a great organization, and it's just neat that people are, you know, playing with giant robots that are going to walk on Mars.
Did you have a chance to talk to any of the current interns, the co-op interns?
I talked to some people who were working there. I had to sort of leave that out of the book because they weren't really allowed to talk to me or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's funny. Whenever these organizations tell people not to talk to me, that's when I get all my information. it happened with Facebook as well when Zuckerberg told everyone not to talk to me there, and suddenly I get a dozen phone calls. So, you know, that doesn't usually work. But I did talk to some people there. I mean, the program has changed a bit. I will say that did have an effect on it. You know, him robbing them made them less trusting of people who were interns and co-ops there. And it was a real embarrassment to them. They were very unhappy, and essentially it was a betrayal, and that's why they came down so hard on him.
Is the story, though, kind of legendary among the subsequent crops of co-op interns?
Yeah, it was for a little while, and now it is, of course, again. It's an amazing story, and what's amazing about it is how essentially no one knew about it other than people at NASA. But, yeah, it was pretty legendary there.
So you said that Roberts understands that he did something wrong. I mean, would he not do it if he had the chance to do it over again?
Yeah, I mean, I've asked him that a number of times, and he regrets it. But he also, you know, he has this feeling that the punishment was way worse than the crime. So he feels that he got way too much time in prison. So there is some anger there as well. He wouldn't recommend doing it. I don't think he would do it again, especially because he was madly in love with this girl. He goes to prison, and he literally writes a letter to her every single day for years. And she, you know, doesn't read them and never talks to him again.
My guest is author Ben Mezrich. We're talking about his latest book, Sex on the Moon, the amazing story behind the most audacious heist in history. We'll return to the story in our discussion in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is author Ben Mezrich. His newest book is called Sex on the Moon, the amazing story behind the most audacious heist in history. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Ben, Thad, in the time after he left prison, actually went back to the University of Utah?
That's right. He went back to his PhD program. It was tricky for him to get back in. The physics department was okay with it, but it was the geology department who worked at the museum where he had stolen fossils from that didn't want him back. But he eventually did get back in, and he was working on finishing up his PhD.
So is he employed now?
So he's, you know, didn't finish his PhD yet. He, you know, still wants to go to space. That's still his goal. Obviously, he can't do it via NASA, but he's hoping to get hired somewhere, private company or something like that. But, you know, he's a smart kid. He'll eventually finish his PhD. In prison, he taught astronomy to the prisoners, and he was known as Moon Rock. He was kind of famous all over prison. And I think, you know, he's trying to move on with his life and trying to sort of do something great. He's also come up with this theory of physics that he's attempting to sort of popularize, which is a way of looking at the world, and it's complex. But he's smart. So hopefully he'll pull himself together.
And there's a nice little ending on this story for Axel Emmermann. He got a really sort of special reward for having you talk about
NASA,
that?
Yeah, NASA named an asteroid after him. So essentially, there's an Emmerman asteroid circling around the sun that's named after him. Also, NASA sent Gibson went to Belgium, to Antwerp, and spoke at Axel's Mineral Club. And so, yeah, he really was the hero of the story in a lot of ways because he brought down the moon rock theft, you know.
Why do you think, we've talked about this on this show in other programs before, but people these days, Americans seem more drawn to fantastic stories that also happen to be true. Than had you sat down to write this as just a novel, it might not generate as much interest as the true story.
Yeah, I mean, this has sort of been my genre from the beginning of my, you know, Bringing Down the House with the MIT kids who took Vegas and then The Social Network. This is what I like to write, you know, stories that read like thrillers that are written kind of cinematically but happen to be true. And people seem to love it. Reviewers don't always love it, but the people who actually buy books and watch movies do love it. And I just think it's a very interesting way to tell a true story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Keith in Fort Worth. Hi, Keith.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I was just calling. The book sounds really interesting, and this is the first time I've heard of it. I know that I'll be going and getting it as soon as I get a chance. But you were saying earlier that you didn't give the guy any money for a story or anything like that. And it sounds like that, you know, ultimately you are benefiting from the book and now from the movie deal. So I was wondering if you ever might feel compelled to, you know, help him out financially. He did lose, you know, 7.5 years of his life over this.
I mean, it's a great question. You know, it's interesting. I mean, when I write these stories, and there's always kind of people who are the real person behind it. And in a lot of ways, it becomes a platform for them. So if he can build on this and sort of, you know, do what he can with it, then that's great. And, you know, I wish him the best. But I don't really pay for stories unless, you know, there's a necessity to do so, because it kind of changes the way you write a story in a way. And also, it's just, I don't know, it's not something that I've really thought about in terms of when you write an article about someone or you write a story about someone and it gets turned into a movie. It's just they're the character, and it's their story in a way. If they wanted to write it, that's something that they could do. But yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I do think that he's going to, you know, move forward and be able to be involved with the movie and be able to sort of use this as a platform in his life.
I'm curious, and obviously you're compensated for selling movie rights, but does the presence of a hit movie, and there've been a couple now, but The Social Network is the one people have almost definitely seen, does that drive people back to the book, or does that pretty much put an end to the period in which you're able to sell hard copies?
No, I mean, the movie is great for the paperback. You know, the way it works is you put out a paperback with the movie. It's, you know, a tie-in edition. And people see the movie, and then they want to know more about the story, and so they pick up the book. You know, it's a great thing when a movie gets made, and it drives, you know, listen, hardcover books, it's tough. People don't pick up hardcover books like they used to. Everything's electronic, and everything's kind of driven by advertising, which publishing doesn't do any of, really. So movies become this massive $20 million ad campaign, which obviously helps out the book a lot. So, yeah, people watch the movie and they want to read the book. You know, The Social Network is a great adaptation of my book, but a lot of people want to know more about Eduardo or more about, you know, the Winklevi. So they go and pick that book up. And with this one as well, once the movie comes out, I think, you know, it drives a lot of the paperback.
So, Ben, we here are just a local talk show, but we get all kinds of letters from people in prison who hope that we'll tell their story. And we get a lot of self-published submissions from people who want to be on the show. I imagine that for you, this is like times a million people with an odd story to tell that want you to be the guy to make them famous.
Yeah, I get a lot of it. I mean, it's almost all Twitter and email now. But yeah, I get, you know, 20 to 30 pitches a week. And I go through them all. And, you know, most of them are not something that I would want to write. The truth is I don't write crime stories. This is the first story I've written where someone actually committed a crime. I mean, nothing, you know, Zuckerberg, whatever you want to say about him, he's certainly not a criminal. You know, the MIT team was just pushing the rules. But this guy really committed a crime. So I'm not really interested in writing crime stories. And I do love these stories about college kids or young people who kind of pull off things. And every now and then there is a really great story. But yeah, I get a lot of submissions. I've kind of sort of built that into my career, and it's great now because that's how I sift through and decide what I'm going to write next, is I just wait for them to come in and just look through them.
Do you have like a list of criteria, like these three things have to be present for you to even, you know, do an online search for what else this story might have to?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, it has to take place in a place I want to go because the simple truth is I'm going to spend a year doing this story. I'm not going to spend a year hanging out where I don't want to go. The person has to be someone I want to spend time with and I want to learn about. But it has to have, you know, elements of sex and money and betrayal and drama. It has to be one of those stories that you think about afterwards. And there's that one sentence hook, which is why essentially I have the relationship with Hollywood that I have, is that I'm kind of doing the same thing, is I'm looking at it as if it's a movie. You know, six MIT kids who took Vegas for millions, or the kid who stole moon rocks to give to his girlfriend. I mean, these are all great one-liners that you know, make it worth reading and worth seeing on the screen.
There are obviously people who love that aspect of your work, that it often fits perfectly with something that would make a great movie. And then there are other people who say, well, Ben Mezrich isn't worth reading because he writes books that would be good movies. Does it bother you that people, you know, sort of fall into those categories?
They say worse things than that, actually. You know, there are definitely a lot of reviewers out there who just don't like what I do with nonfiction. They feel that, you know, I'm writing movies, or I'm, you know, bastardizing nonfiction or whatever it is. And it kind of cracks me up. I mean, it fits into a long line of nonfiction, of taking these true stories and writing them as thrillers. And I think there's a real synergy between movies and books now, and I don't think there should be this differentiation. I mean, let's face it. People want the content from a variety of different ways. They want to see it as a movie. They love watching TV, and they like to read books. And I think when you try and separate them out and say a nonfiction has to be written in this documentary, boring style, and you can't, you know, have a conversation between two characters because you don't have it on tape. That seems foolish to me. I mean, you can interview the people, you know what was said, you know they talked about moon rocks, for instance, and you can either write they talked about moon rocks, which I think is a very boring and an easy way to go about it, or you can, you know, create the conversation between the two people. I know what was said, I just wasn't there to get the exact words. So I think it's a very viable form of nonfiction. But I will always be attacked for it. And it's, you know, it's controversial to some people, but to me it just seems very valid.
Would you write about politics if the right story presented itself?
I've thought about that. I've been pitched a few. I haven't found the right story yet. I'm not very political a person, so it would have to be something that is beyond politics. It's similar to, like, Facebook. You know, I never would have sat down and written about Facebook. But there was this sort of Shakespearean tale of two best friends torn apart, and you threw in these 6'5" identical twin Olympic rowers, and you kind of had a great story there. So it really had nothing to do with Facebook, and that would be similar with politics. It wouldn't just be some sort of political story. There would have to be something, you know, really great in there that had nothing to do with it.
I would imagine you're at a place in your career and financially where you could take your time if you wanted to, but it seems like you've always got something in the works. Is that more about how your brain works than anything else?
I mean, a lot of it is that. You know, I just don't sit still ever. I'm always kind of wanting to do something. And I get intrigued by these stories and they come about. But the other thing is, you know, I've lived in this industry for a while. There are ups and there are downs. And people think, you know, I'm a one-hit wonder. But the reality is my first book came out in 1996. Just nobody read it. So I understand that, you know, the window is open right now. And it would be, you know, I'm going to take advantage of it as much as possible. People are sending me phenomenal stories. And I can get inside them now. I have, you know, the people I need who can get me inside things. So I'm going to tell the stories now. But, yeah, I don't, you know, for me, writing is this kind of need. It's this horrible thing. I mean, actual writing is a miserable process, but it's something I need to do. So every time a story comes to me, I can't just say, oh, maybe next year. I have to do it right away.
What were you always comfortable with writing about people who, for whatever reason, would not necessarily come off really likable in your books? I'm thinking about someone like Mark Zuckerberg, who, there's nothing personal between you, but now I'm quite sure he doesn't like you at all.
Well, you know, originally he definitely didn't like me. I mean, he called me the Jackie Collins of Silicon Valley. And I think Facebook, I was their enemy number one. But I was actually at my college reunion, and Sheryl Sandberg, who was the COO of Facebook, was in my class, and she came over to me and was like, you know, we actually love the movie. They did like the movie a lot, and it did a lot for them. So I don't think Mark hates me like he used to. You know, there is that. I like to be liked, I think, you know, I am like these people. You know, there's a lot of similarities between me and the people I write about. I want to be like them. I kind of live vicariously through them. I was this geeky guy in college who, you know, I wasn't smart enough to start Facebook, but I knew what it was like to sort of want to be a member of a finals club or want to meet the girls that I couldn't meet. So I feel like I identify with them and they identify with me. And, you know, some of the people I write about, I stay good friends with. The MIT kids who took Vegas, those guys are my buddies, and I hang out with them. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg isn't going to be my friend, probably, which is sad. But, you know, the Winklevi like me.
Will your it's funny that these two guys who would have been relatively obscure are known everywhere by that nickname.
Well, it's hard to miss those guys. You could not invent these guys. 6'5", identical twin Olympic rowers who finish each other's sentences. You know, I remember I met them for the first time in a hotel room. And Tyler or Cameron, I don't remember which one, was like, you know, you look at us and you think we must be the bad guys. Because if this were an 80s movie, we would be dressed up as skeletons chasing the Karate Kid around the gym. And I put that in the book and then Sorkin put it in the movie. And it's just such a cool line. But the truth is, you know, they are likable guys. They just stand out and they won't give up. And they're very entitled. I mean, they're everything you see. They came from a rich family. And they expect the world to work a certain way. And a guy like Zuckerberg, who, you know, he comes from a very different world, he takes it and runs with it. And to them, you know, this is wrong. And they're going to spend the rest of their lives trying to fight it. They're amazing characters. And they're actually genuinely nice guys who are just very entitled.
Is it just a coincidence that you have written almost exclusively about men?
You know, I get asked that a lot recently. My mom just wrote me an email the other day, and I was like, why won't you write about a woman? Well, I haven't been pitched the right story yet. When I get the right story, I will do it. It's just, you know, it's mainly, I think, because Bringing Down the House, every guy read that book. Every college kid, every 21-year-old guy reads it on the way to Vegas, which, by the way, I feel bad about because they get to Vegas and then they lose. And so that kind of turned on a very large male audience. So I think the majority of my pitches came from guys. But since The Social Network, I've actually been getting a lot more women pitching me, which is great. I would love to write a story about a woman who does something crazy, and sooner or later I think I will, it just hasn't come to me yet.
Has it gotten really easy for you, especially after two successful movies, one of which is an Oscar winner, to just step back once the process begins of filmmaking and not worry about what will happen to this story that you've told?
Well, I know I was incredibly lucky to get someone like Aaron Sorkin and then someone like David Fincher making that movie. I mean, you know, it was very easy to cede control to them because they're so good at what they do. I've been very lucky. Kevin Spacey essentially discovered me in Hollywood, and he signed on, you know, Bringing Down the House in 21. And he's actually been involved in every one of my projects. I've sold 5 or 6 projects with him. And Sex on the Moon as well. And so, you know, you have people you trust and you know that they're going to get it to the right people. And I've been very fortunate. It's always hard to sort of step back and do nothing. I mean, I'm always on set, but I have no power. So, you know, you got to let the right people do what they can do.
The new book, to be followed by a movie by author Ben Mezrich, is called Sex on the Moon, the amazing story behind the most audacious heist in history. Ben, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.